TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Alexander Coburn investigates Al Gore. For 1 year, Nation columnist and author Alexander Coburn investigated Al Gore's public and personal life with his co-author Jeffrey St. Clair. They looked up his lengthy voting record from the day he entered Congress in 1976. They interviewed people who knew Gore and researched the history of his campaigns. In this lively speech, filled with biting wit and humor, Coburn takes up all major issues brought up by Gore supporters: the death penalty, abortion, and potential Supreme Court appointments. He argues that none of these would benefit from a Gore presidency. Recorded at a book release party for Coburn and St. Clair's new book, Al Gore, A User's Manual. The setting is the backyard of AK Press, an alternative San Francisco publisher. It is the evening of September 9th. A barbecue is going, and there is standing room only for a writer who is fearless, funny, and irreverent. Here is Alexander Coburn.
We are in the final spasm of our quadrennial theater. Very expensive theater. It costs hundreds of millions of dollars now. Corporations are going full tilt, pouring soft money, hard money, into the hands of the electoral machine. And we are seeing on the Democratic side a traditional process at this time. After Labor Day, you get what's called unity. So suddenly we have a guy who has, as we all know, been on the right wing of the Democratic Party, who never met a corporate dollar he didn't like. He makes one speech in L.A. after fervently embracing his wife. It does not escape Al Gore's attention that portions of the Democratic base might not vote. Worse still, they might even vote for Nader. So he makes one speech, which is called populist. It's populism for the middle class, of course. At which point they say there's a new Al Gore. He kissed his wife, and he talked about the middle-class populist needs. I don't know how many arguments you have a day or a week with Gore people. It's a stupefying experience. I never thought I would think this much about Al Gore, by the way. You know? Al Gore. So we enter the unenviable experience of reading about and studying Al Gore and looking up about Al Gore, interviewing people about Al Gore. It's much worse than doing Bill Clinton. Al Gore, it's the tedium of insensate ambition since 3 months old. His parents projecting their dreams and hopes upon him. When he was born, they put his birth on the front page of the Tennessean paper. Significant event. But still, you meet people. I met a guy the other day and he said, it's the death penalty. I said, what? Death penalty? You just have to vote for Gore. So I said, the death penalty, you know that he's enthusiastically supported legislation that expanded the federal death penalty by 50 offenders. I think jaywalking is now, you know. You do it three times, they kill you. The Effective Death Penalty Act, when you want to appeal on habeas corpus to the feds, you can't do it. So, how in the world can anybody who opposes the death penalty even think of voting for Al Gore? So you say that, and the person says, well, yes, in a way, but he's better than George Bush. I say, no, he's much worse than George Bush. Then you see cast about, and he said, well, Bush, is, look at the way he's killing people in Texas. And it's true, he's the number one serial killer, but Bush, the governor of Texas, is not a particularly powerful individual, you know, relative to the legislature. He inherited all this stuff. But the parole board is powerful, the system is powerful, and old George just goes along. And he's been there 6 years. Al Gore has been an active leader in these matters since 1976. This is when he first entered Congress. On what is now what you would now call the Southern Strategy, which is devised by Nixon and Kevin Phillips. Al Gore ran, as he's always run, from the right, except for this tiny blip at the Democratic Convention in the year 2000. He ran ferociously against choice. He ran against homosexuality. He said that was an aberration. He ran a fairly thinly disguised racist campaign, very anti-labor. In other words, you know, straight right-wing southerner. That's Al Gore. It's always been Al Gore. There's never been a moment when it hasn't been Al Gore. You say all this, and the person then says, you know, you have this argument with people, and you can see that your words are getting sort of almost through, and then, boom. I say, why is it that you think there's this brief moment when you're in the voting booth and your hand is poised above, you know, the mechanisms of your democratic choice, such as it is, you're suddenly going to dispose of the fact that Orrin Hatch is on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and therefore any judge that Al Gore put up, who by any conceivable measure might be a tolerable human being, will be instantly vetoed by Orrin Hatch. You know, not to mention the rest of the Republican Senate. The person says, but George Bush will get in there. And then you say the things about the Supreme Court. You say, well, who's the most liberal person on the Supreme Court? Who? And they say, you say Stevens, right? Stevens, yes. Who appointed Stevens? Well, I don't know. Gerald Ford, Republican president. So now the person is, you've got them defiant now. And you say, okay, Stevens, who's the next best? Maybe even more liberal. Souter. You're right. Souter from New Hampshire. Gerald Ford, they said, who shall I appoint? And the Attorney General, Levy from Chicago, and his chief advisor, Vice Presidential candidate Cheney, who was, of course, Ford's leader, they said, Stevens is the guy. Then Souter. I suppose they thought he was a conservative. Souter's terrific. For people who think this is the be-all and end-all of everything, Roe v. Wade, he actually reaffirmed the decision, Mr. Souter. And then you say, well, who are the four worst justices? Worst, absolute pigs appointed in the post-war period. Truman, four terrible ones. Eisenhower, of course, appointed Brennan, one of the best. Kennedy, the guy who wrote the most passionate dissent to Roe v. Wade, said this is a decision which will live in infamy, was the guy appointed by Kennedy, who was a white, who was a Catholic, you know. Who was the guy who wrote Roe v. Wade? Blackmun, appointed by Nixon. In short, the fact of the matter is you simply can't predict. You can't do it. You can go right through it. I mean, it's true. Bush appoints a great man like Souter, appoints Clarence Thomas, the best and the worst. Clinton, you know, two totally pro-corporate people, Ginsburg and Breyer. Never met a corporation they didn't like. So to say that all our politics, all our decisions have to be completely dependent on our hope that a lion like Al Gore, in whom leonism has not been visible at any point in his entire career, will suddenly muster up his strength and appoint a good justice, which is now going to be put through the nomination process, given a ringing endorsement by Orrin Hatch of Utah. And then we'll go on the court and do all the things that you expect he's going to do or she's going to do. It's ridiculous. It's the ultimate parody of the political process. Ultimate one. Yet, many people do that. My colleague at The Nation, Katha Pollitt, has written passionate columns saying it's too serious. The stakes are too high. What stakes? Al Gore gets in. Let's have a tiny bio. Gore's dad is a New Deal liberal. The state of Tennessee entirely depends on the TVA and the Oak Ridge thing. And the duty of any Tennessee politician is to ensure that enough government money flows into the great state of Tennessee. That's about it. And Al Gore Sr. did his bit, and he actually, a flicker of decency, did inflame the old boy's breast. He was against the war in Vietnam. And in 1970, he went down. A friend of mine actually was in Gore Jr.'s office in 1980, trying to tell the guy to do the right thing in a case involving a little kid who'd been at Oak Ridge. The little kid was dying of leukemia. He was like 2 or 3 years old. And the Oak Ridge people wanted to have fresh, young, experimental mice in the form of humans because they were secretly doing experiments for NASA. NASA was worried about John Glenn and the other astronauts being bombarded by solar flares. And they wanted to know what massive doses of radiation did to people. So they said to Oak Ridge, what can you do? Oak Ridge put out the word. They say, any kids really sick, like really sick of leukemia? There were some. They got him in. They said to the parents, there is a little chance for Tommy, you know. Just little tiny chance. We'll put him in this cell and we'll zap him really big time with radiation. This little kid went in and they put him with 50 cages of white mice and zapped him, taking studious notes of the result. The kid died. And this became somewhat of an issue. It all began to trickle out in the late 70s. Al Gore at that time was carving a name for himself as a mighty grandstander on TV. He'd written his master's thesis on the use of TV in politics. And he was holding hearings. They were the Permanent Investigations Committee of the Science and Technology Committee, as you all knew. And he would do showy interrogations of the people making children's nightwear. You know, you'd haul in the people making the nightwear. You mean to say you allowed children to be in this nightwear without proper blah, blah, blah? And, you know, the people would say, well, we didn't think it was as bad. Oh, you did you? And the cameras would roll and Al Gore chest would puff up. And he became somewhat of a staple on the national TV. People said, there goes Gore, the man who's standing up for flame-retardant children's nightwear. Now they say, the guy I know goes in and says, you know, now this is not a pretty case, this little boy. And Gore immediately said when he saw him, I wish the fuck I'd never seen you. He said, why? He said, I have national ambitions. I do not wish to make enemies of the nuclear establishment at Oak Ridge. That's when the guy I know said, you should do the right thing. That's when Gore pointed at his picture of his dad on the wall and said, he did the right thing and see where it got him. So in the end, Al did hold hearings. But this time we didn't see the mighty Al, the lion-like, courageous Al, bullying the scientists and researchers, these Nazis in the Oak Ridge labs who'd been putting a little kid in, more than 19 kids, with the white mice. No, it was a polite and deferential Al Gore. Oh, thank you, Professor. Most interesting, Professor. That is an extremely illuminating statement, Professor. And the only witness for the kid was the mother, who was a very simple, effective, but a lonely working-class mom. And the hearings were over in a day. That's all you ever really need to know about Al Gore. That was Al Gore. His very first act. People now say, at least the environment. He's saving the environment. It's another myth, you know. People say gridlock. Clinton and Gore rushed to the Northwest. They said, we must get the Carpenters Union and the Earth First together. We must hash it out. Bad day for the spotted owl. Very bad day. Because what you got, of course, was regulated, orderly pillage. Of course. Now, the only thing standing between the spotted owl, just as a purely indicator species of general destruction, is a federal judge up there in Seattle appointed by Reagan, Judge William Dwyer, the last hope of the spotted owl, literally. And Dwyer keeps saying, I am shocked. He said, the things that the environmental groups have signed on to, I cannot understand. Oh, William, wake up, smell the coffee. All through these years, you've had Babbitt, Frampton, and Gore doing orderly, regulated destruction of the Endangered Species Act, which Al Gore was the very first person. Here's a little nugget for you. Next time you're doing battle with the, you know, befuddled Goreite, say to them, you know, what was the very first thing Al Gore did about the environment in Congress? Of course they won't know. You'll say, well, the very first thing was he tried to save the Clinch River Breeder Reactor. That was his first assigned task. The second thing he did was to try successfully to save the Tellico Dam, a totally useless dam. It was a dam that existed to be a dam and put money into the pockets of the cement makers and the concrete mixers and the contractors of Tennessee. No other known purpose. Gore created the God Squad. The God Squad is when the squad that gets together and they say, next, and they say, snail data. And the God Squad says, well, all right, what's the usefulness of the snail data? Nil. Snail data just swims around in the river, being a snail data. What would the snail daughter's extinction mean? A mighty Adam. The daughters and sons of the cement manufacturers of Tennessee will go to nicer schools, have bigger cars, live a rich and fulfilled life, probably go to jail for bribing politicians. The normal part and parcel of our great social life. Done. Snail daughter goes. That's what the God Squad did. That was done by Al Gore, his first achievement. Okay, what else does our Gore man say? I better hurry this up. People are beginning to think this can't be true. Defense. Now, you know, in 193 AD, there was an emperor called Pertinax. He was quite a nice old boy. In the Roman legions, the Praetorian Guard didn't want Pertinax. They thought he wasn't giving enough money, so they killed him, and they put the emperorship up for auction to the highest bidder. We are now exactly in that process right now. That the military, all the joint chiefs, outgoing and standing, said, we need to have 4% of gross domestic product. Got to have it. Otherwise, America is fighting with both hands tied behind its back. Not a tank can roll, not a F-23 can get built, etc., etc. George Bush, flanked by General Schwarzkopf, Colin Powell. And Al Gore is saying, I'll raise you. I'll raise you. I'll raise you 0.25% of GDP. Okay. And then Bush says, I'll raise you again. 0.5%. I'll raise you. 4. What about 5? Do I hear 5? 5. Now, if they get 4%, none of them ever say how much 4% of GDP is. It's actually quite a lot of change. And a tremendous amount of change. And it's true, actually, the defense budget is buying less and less. Why? Because the main revenue from the budget is being garnered by huge aerospace firms, electronics firms, mostly in the great state of Connecticut, where the man of God himself, Senator Joe, is, actually. You know, we're talking about the Seawolf submarine, we're talking about the F-23, we're talking about Sikorsky, all in Connecticut, a truly horrible state, by the way. I don't want to offend Connecticutans here. But if you're here, you're not in Connecticut, so my point is kind of proved. But the budget is no longer about paying, you know, having the ordinary people in the field. You want to build incredibly high-value product. You know, what corporations want is subservient labor making things which you then charge the taxpayer staggering amounts of money. That's why, in the end, we'll probably have one plane costing $300 billion. And we'll have total disarmament otherwise, which would be quite good. Think of it that way. So what is the whole thing really about? The thing clearly is about, you know, can the left forces in any way group for a little leap forward? There have been opportunities through the post-war period. You know, we had the end of the 60s. You know, a tremendous amount of people had come out of the civil rights movement, gone into the anti-war movement, you know, done tremendous political work, done demonstrations, you know, decades of experience crammed into one decade. 70s, you have a whole new lot of causes. 80s, you again have, each time the opportunity is somehow not there. At the end of the 60s, a possibility. At the end of the 70s. At the end of the 80s, you had the possibility of the rainbow, which has blown completely. Jackson had a lot of blame for that, I have to say. So is there a possibility at this time that there'll be any kind of grouping? Can something come together? Maybe, maybe not. NATO has his faults. NATO's not perfect. He's the best we've got right now, I think, for the job he's doing. And he's done a lot. He's been at it since 1960. We all want him in the debates. He's quick on his feet. He's smart. He's a very smart guy. How we all would love to see Ralph Nader in the ring with Al Gore and George Bush. It will be fun. So it seems to me so obvious. You want to give some beef to our crowd. Our crowd across the country. Green Party coalitions. Is the Nader candidacy really engendering, helping along a movement? Well, in my observations in various states, it is. You know, it's not just Ralph running around. It should be, you know, in the Midwest. There's some good labor organizers hard at work with locals. In Vermont, the Progressive Party there, not Representative Bernard Sanders, I hasten to say, who votes more Democrat than the Democratic leader, but, you know, a genuinely different party, is using and being helped by the Nader candidacy. Gore, I wrote at the beginning of the book, Gore represents everything that is wrong with the Democratic Party, which some might think to be an unnecessary statement. And Tipper, I'm not going to say anything. No, you think I was going to say something unpleasant about Tipper? No, I regard Tipper as the first, you know, the most obvious side of Al being a complete nightmare, a nice, fun-loving young woman in Washington who one fateful night, you know, happened to go out with Al. And it's really been a very rough road to hoe for her ever since. Why? Al, I'll give you an example. After the Vietnam War, where Al has been variously traumatized, that's one line he has about the war. Actually, he had a pretty safe war. He felt he had to go for his own political career, and maybe because of his dad, I don't know, who was in the middle of an election. He went, unlike most people being drafted to Vietnam, he went to William Westmoreland, head of the U.S. Army, and said, should I go to Vietnam? And Westmoreland said, yes, you should, my boy. Will it be dangerous? And Westmoreland said, not necessarily, and gave him ensured that he got a job as a reporter. And one of his mates in the army said, if Al was telling the truth, he'd say he had a great war. Sat around smoking dope all the time. Which is a good thing. Probably the best thing he ever did. If you're smoking dope, you're not shooting Vietnamese revolutionaries. He gets back to Nashville, Tennessee. Tipper gets a job on the Tennessee, and as does Al. Tipper actually is a very talented photographer. Many people say if she'd been, you know, allowed to go as a photographer, she'd have gone great places. Unbeknownst to her, the snake or the worm of ambition is gnawing at Al's heart. He suddenly says, the newspaper basically says to the old congressman, your day is done. Fred, or whatever his name was, 4th District. Move on. So Fred moves on to pasture. In goes Al. Says, I'm going to run. He goes home, and he says to Tipper, oh, by the way, I'm running for Congress. And drops to the ground, such as the closest of their relationship, and does 50 push-ups right there. Tipper is very sad to lose her job, because Al's mother says, you've got to go to Washington and be a Washington wife. The most degraded form of existence known on the planet, probably. She's at home raising children. Al's, of course, out making policy, posturing on flame-retardant nightwear and the other heavy duties of a legislator. And bringing home, occasionally, just when Tipper thinks a nice night together at last, the candles lit, rat-a-tat-tat on the door. Who is it? Newt Gingrich. Al Gore's best friend in Congress. Together, they discuss the future. Incredible protrusions of hot air, levitating the Gore mansion. And Tipper says, and at the end of which, Al, in 1988, runs for Congress. A truly disgusting race in which his only function, or two, he introduces Willie Horton to the world, first person to campaign against Dukakis in the primaries, raising the issue of Willie Horton, which is then, of course, handed on to Bush, who makes great play with it against Dukakis in the fall. And he has been absolutely humiliated in primary after primary. In the famous Southern primaries, I don't know if any of you remember this old history, where he was meant to go great. Jesse Jackson does incredibly. This is Jackson's year. He wins Michigan. Gore stays in. We have a thing on this in the book. No one's ever pointed this out. Why did he stay in the race? He stayed in the race to try and cut down Jackson in New York, which he does by brigading with Ed Koch, the mayor of New York, and conducting an actually filthy campaign against Jackson, which is to some extent successful. At the end of this campaign, Tipper says, I can't take this anymore. Al says, I'll clean up. He goes into a form of therapy, and he comes back one day and says, it's going to be okay. Tipper says, really? We can go on a holiday. We can do stuff. He says, I'm going to write a book. Oh. He writes Earth in the Balance, which means he's away from home in his writing den across Washington, night after night for about 2 years. He finishes. Tipper's delighted. And just when she thinks in 1992, maybe a holiday, who knows, Al goes rushing off to Rio de Janeiro to tout his book to the environmental summit, and the phone call comes to the Rio from the Clinton camp, will you run as vice presidential candidate? Poor old Tipper. So I always think, now what have we got? I'll just close with this thought. Suddenly, what do we have after years of being told to torture ourselves every night before retiring about the Christian right? We now have Al Gore, born again. Tipper and he are born again. I don't know how many of you knew that. Most definitely born again. Southern Baptist, born again, which if you believe all the demonology is terrible in and of itself. Bush wanted Jesus Day, as if we haven't got a lot, I thought. What's one more going to make a difference? But Gore has what would Jesus do? That's him. You'd think that liberals would say, what? What would Jesus do? What about the separation of powers? What about the first constitution? You have Lieberman, who has probably talked more about God than even in his hottest moments Robertson did. Why are they doing it? Well, the main thing is none of them can talk about reality. They can't talk about prison populations. They can't talk about rates for exploitation. They can't talk about trade treaties. When he's talking to workers in Detroit, Lieberman said, you know, the advantage of bringing God is in it invests a human being, a worker, with dignity. But did he follow up and then say, you know, dignity would be a wage, which isn't something where you need to have two jobs. Dignity would be where you work in a meatpacking plant where you're so cold and working so fast you're cutting off all your fingers. None of that. No. God is in wonderful ways, it always has been, of changing the subject while sounding pious at the time. So what we have really is all the liberals' worst nightmares, which is what I said. It's the old bait and switch of American politics. Give us money to beat back the Christian threat, and you end up with Al Gore and Joe Lieberman. Thank you.
That was Alexander Coburn, nationally syndicated columnist with The Nation and New York Press, author of many books such as Corruptions of Empire or Whiteout, a book on the CIA drug trade that he co-authored with Jeffrey St. Clair. He was recorded at a book party for their most recent book, Al Gore, A User's Manual. You can get a 60-minute audio tape of the full talk by Alexander Coburn for $12. For a credit card order, call toll-free at 1-877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. Or send us your $12 check by mail to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening.